Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, if you think Hinduism and Christianity are like oil and water, and Islam and Judaism don't mix, consider the thesis of Karen Armstrong's new book, The Great Transformation: The Beginnings of Our Religious Traditions. She writes that the major world religions underwent a similar period of genesis between the years 200 and 900 BC, that the command to love thy neighbor lay at the heart of all these new creeds, and that Buddha, Socrates, and Elijah all marked a decisive break with earlier faiths. And if you're willing to make that leap with Karen Armstrong, a former nun, maybe you'll follow her one leap further and look for a way out of the war and hatred the world is embroiled in today through rediscovering of our ancient values, which she hopes will take place. We will go there now and ask, would Jesus really have sheltered illegal immigrants? And would Muhammad have had a convert to Christianity executed? With author and scholar Karen Armstrong, author of A History of God and other books, and now The Great Transformation, The Beginnings of Our Religious Traditions. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
You know, I hope I didn't oversimplify the point of your book too much. So let me start with an intriguing point in the title. Why search for the beginning of our religious traditions rather than, say, the beginnings of our religions? Did you make that distinction on purpose?
I did. Religious traditions, because this was the genesis of all the great world faiths, which developed many, many, many different strands. But this was a period from 900 to 200 BCE, when in four distinct corners of the world, working independently of one another, the great world ideologies, faiths, philosophical rationalism of Greeks is not, which is one of these ideologies, is not really entirely
right.
Religious.
And even in the way I presented the introduction, people might have been surprised to hear Socrates listed alongside the Buddha,
yes,
or Elijah.
But I'd be a bit more iffy about Elijah, actually, because I think he belongs more to the old world, though he is beginning to make a transition. But in four corners of the world, in China, India, Israel, and Greece, the traditions, ideologies that have continued to nourish humanity came into being or had their roots. So that you have Confucianism and Taoism in China, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism in India, monotheism in Israel, and philosophical rationalism in Greece. And they all, despite their intriguing and revealing differences, have a profound similarity. So Socrates is not out of place there at all. He was concerned, like most of the axial sages, not with doctrine or belief or the supernatural. This is a peculiarly Western concept. But with the attempt to be good, how do you become a humane person that transcends selfishness, greed, and partiality, and in so doing encounters a transcendence within the self?
So why would that have been going on in these four centers of the world at the same time? Presumably at that time, 200 to 900 BC or BCE, China, India, Israel, Greece did not have a lot of contact with each other.
No, they didn't. China in particular was cut off and thought of the whole world as simply China. There were certain conditions that prevailed that happened to these axial age people. The period is being called the axial age because it was the pivot of the axis of the spiritual history of humanity. In a sense, we've never gone beyond those original insights. But one of the things that they had in common was that, like our own society, or like our own times, these regions were engulfed in violence. Violence that had reached a chronic and unprecedented level. Of course, the violence that we're seeing today makes this ancient violence look puny in comparison, but iron weaponry had been discovered, so wars were becoming more deadly. Coercive states were developing that depended upon an army and a police force. The beginnings of capitalism were developing in the market, so there was much economic aggression. And in every single case, the religious change was initiated by rejection of violence, a profound recoil from the violence that was tearing society apart. And in discovering, looking for the causes, the root causes of humanity, of violence in the human psyche, greed, insecurity, fear, the Axial Age sages began to discover the inner self, the inner world.
And as you point out, the Hindu idea of karma is a lot like the Old Testament's golden rule.
Well, all these traditions, except the Greeks, developed what has been called the golden rule. The first person to formulate the golden rule, do not do to others as you would not have done to you, was Confucius, who made it absolutely clear 500 years before Jesus that religion was inseparable from altruism. That if you lived the golden rule, as he said, all day and every day, you encountered a transcendence of being. And 500 years later, Rabbi Hillel, when approached by a pagan who promised to convert to Judaism if the rabbi would recite the whole of Jewish teaching while he stood on one leg, said, that which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the Torah. The rest is commentary.
The famous quote, the rest is commentary. But Judaism also had been saying that for thousands of years earlier, hadn't it?
Not really, no. I think the rabbinic Judaism, which starts to develop in the first century and has this great flowering later, is a latter-day reassertion of the ancient
golden rule
of the ancient monotheism that was developing in Israel. Now, some of the biblical writers, in particular the priestly authors, tell the Israelites that they must love their neighbor and love the stranger too. If a stranger lives with you in your land, do not molest him. You must treat him as one of your own people and love him as yourself, for you were strangers in Egypt. But there are other parts of the Bible, as we know, which retreated from this very lofty teaching and talks in terms of massacres and intolerance, as does the New Testament too.
But getting back to the simultaneous development of the do unto others ethic in these four parts of the world, it sounds like you're saying, really, that the nature of religion followed technology.
I think it's certainly true that humanity had reached a certain stage of development. Individualism was beginning to emerge in the cities. In order to run a good market economy, people had to think of themselves as autonomous individuals instead of putting the group or the tribe first, as they had done in the more traditional societies. And ideologies all developed in societies that were in the cutting edge of change. Israel had enjoyed its greatest Axial Age flowering when the Jewish people were deported to Babylonia, and there they were in the capital of the region. And you have an astonishing burst of religious thinking and religious innovation at that time.
My guest on WNYC is Karen Armstrong. Her latest book is called The Great Transformation, The Beginning of the Religious Traditions. We can take phone calls for her on this history and on how it relates to today, which we'll talk a little bit more explicitly about with Karen Armstrong as we go. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And one thing I was really struck by in reading your book is that because the focus is on this period of 200 to 900 BCE, the so-called Axial Age, you mostly leave out the two biggest current world faiths, Christianity and Islam, and to the extent that they're dealt with here, it's as outgrowths of Judaism.
Yes, and that is certainly what they were. The Jewish Axial Age was truncated early because of the vicissitudes of Middle Eastern history. at that time, and it ran out of steam. It enjoyed a wonderful flowering later, in which rabbinic Judaism, alongside Christianity, and much later Islam, went back to these to these ideals and developed them and brought them very much interestingly into line with the other great world faiths. And that's what people have done throughout history. They have continually, in times of trouble, whether they're Chinese or Indian, gone back to these great figures, gone back to these great thinkers who were towering religious geniuses. These people in the Axial Age worked as hard at being good and discovering a remedy for the spiritual ills of humanity as we work in trying to find a cure for cancer. That was their priority.
Now, you talk about the rise of these do unto others ethics as a reaction to the amount of war that was going on at the time and violence. Maybe it's too cynical to think this way, but why wouldn't the tenets of the time have followed power and you know, developed in such a way as to enable the power structure to do what it was doing, rather than developing an opposition to it?
Well, of course, the Axial Age sages were trying to put up a principled opposition to politicians who weren't interested at all. And you have this particularly in China. The Confucians were longing to curtail the violence that was unfolding in China and introduce the Golden Rule and a compassionate form of living, and were preaching nonviolence. But the rulers didn't want to know. They preferred to follow the political scientists, who had a much more cynical and realistic view. And similarly, as we find today, it's very difficult to incarnate these lofty ideals in the bloody reality of everyday politics. And that has always been the prophets of Israel were speaking out very much against their kings. As Nathan said when he went to King David and pointed out his wrongdoing, "You are the man, examine your own conduct." And Jesus, Muhammad, were both acting in opposition to the establishment. So the establishment of the day, the political establishment, even today, dare I suggest, politicians are not really interested in following their religious leaders. They want perhaps their tanks to be blessed, but they don't necessarily want to practice the Golden Rule.
And since you see this development of the Golden Rule at a time that you see as parallel to our age, because of all the violence at that time and all the violence at this time, do you foresee, or do you see already happening, some kind of ethical revival?
I think we've got to have one, because I think now the challenge is that we are living in a global village and we have to apply the Golden Rule globally. The Axial Age sages were ahead of us there because they all insisted that we couldn't confine our benevolence to our own group, to our own people, to our own people who are congenial to us. We had to have what the Chinese sage Moti called Jian Ai, concern for everybody.
And yet so much of the violence in the world today is violence of a sort of religious nationalist nature.
Yes, and this is an example of bad religion. Not all religion is good. Religion is very hard to do well. You have bad religion as you have bad art and bad cooking. And a lot of religious people basically don't want to give up their egos and be compassionate. Religious people very often want to be right rather than compassionate. And sometimes when I'm talking to religious people and talking about the quintessential importance of compassion, I see them looking mutinous and balked.
We'll continue and take your phone calls and see if you're feeling mutinous toward Karen Armstrong's ideas. Her new book, The Great Transformation, published by Knopf. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her new book called The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Our Religious Traditions. Let's go to the phones, which are full at 212-433-WNYC. Nicole in Farmingville, you're on WNYC. Hello, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Good. I just wanted to ask. You know, I've been brought up Catholic my whole life. I'm 20 years old now. And I'm very turned off by the whole institution of the Catholic Church. And I just wanted to see what kind of guidance or direction she could give to, you know, young people my age who are feeling the same way.
I think a lot of people, myself included, I went through a very similar journey there, Nicole. I also fell away from the institution of the Catholic Church.
You were a nun at one time.
I was a nun and came out of all that experience very painfully. But I wouldn't make a too big a deal of it. Don't allow yourself to get caught up in anger with the institution, however irritating or upsetting or indeed disgraceful sometimes our institutions are, because that means that you, instead of finding peace, you are letting this get to you, and you're stuck in what the Buddhists would call an unskillful state, where instead of going beyond yourself, you're enmeshed in angry thoughts. I think the thing to do is go. Never mind about the popes and the bishops and what they say. Go back to the Gospels. Go back to what Jesus was saying, which is what all the axial sages were saying, is that it's the practice of compassion.
Yeah.
That is religion. Now, I was with the Dalai Lama in September, and he said there's no need to convert from one religion to another. He was talking actually to a girl, an American girl who'd become a Buddhist. He said, you might just as well have stayed Christian. He said, all these religions teach the same. They all teach religion. My religion is kindness. And I think if you try to be kind, Nicole, day by day, hour by hour, to everybody, to develop a concern for everybody, not just your own group, you'll find yourself on the religious path.
Great. Thank you very much.
Nicole, thank you very much. One of the things in the book that raised my eyebrows was that you said the original creators of our religious traditions not only weren't interested in dogma, they weren't interested in metaphysics.
Not at all. They were interested in promoting a religion that was doing things rather than thinking things and believing things. The prophets of Israel didn't come out at all with doctrines or metaphysical notions. Jesus didn't actually spend much time talking about the Trinity or original sin. And Muhammad in the Quran calls metaphysics zanna, self-indulgent guesswork that makes people quarrelsome.
And yet one of the purposes of religion, at least traditionally, is to try to explain the mysteries of life, like where life came from and when time began and things like that.
Well, no, I don't think it is. I think that's the job of science. And the early cosmogonies, the early accounts of the creation of the world, were not intended as literal accounts of the beginning of life. They were theological reflections about the nature of life itself. The Buddha had a monk who kept on pestering him about, was there a God? Who had created the world? Was the world created in time, or had it always been there? And he wasn't getting on with his compassionate behaviour and his meditation. And the Buddha told him he was like a man who'd been shot with a poisoned arrow, but who wouldn't accept any medical treatment until he'd found out what village the man who had shot him came from.
So in terms of priorities, but still there are some things that science will say that it can't explain, you know, despite the Big Bang. What came before the Big Bang? So, I mean, there are mysteries of life that return to religion to give us meaning around, no?
Religion is designed not to answer our questions, but to help us to ask them and to hold us in an attitude of awe and wonder. And I think a lot of science does that too. Religion's often at its best when it helps us to pose a question, and at its worst when it seeks to answer them.
It sounds like a very contemporary viewpoint. Did people believe that in 200 to 900 BC?
Yeah, they had no interest in metaphysics. And when you start having someone like Plato begin to say, this is orthodox opinion, you must believe this, this is a sign that the axial age is coming to an end.
So the difference between Socrates and Plato.
Socrates, exactly, as far as we know.
Anand in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Karen Armstrong. Hello.
Yes, I have recently written a book called Green History of Religion. Our professor, Karen Armstrong, has totally missed the point of axial religion. She can't explain why independently these axial thoughts developed in China, India, Middle East, and Greece. Now, I have concluded in my research, PhD research, that there was a tremendous climate change between 6000 to 2000 BC. And all these, one thing that you would notice is that all these religions took place near rivers. These are river civilization, except, of course, in Greece, it was more different.
And so you think environmental conditions led to the development of a golden rule, do unto others, ethic?
Yes, this war she's talking about, violence, it is because of the environment which changed. And all these regions, the Middle East was once upon a time a greenery.
All right, let me get a response.
Yes, indeed, that's an interesting idea. And I know that the Chinese, for example, were very interested in how they made their very difficult land viable. I don't quite go along with it just being environmental catastrophe. We know that there was probably environmental catastrophe, as you say, in the Middle East and in the Eastern Mediterranean. But that's before the Axial Age started, and not all the people in the Middle East or the Eastern Mediterranean took part in this. It was only the Israelites, only the Greeks who took part in it, not the people of ancient Mesopotamia, for example. But it's a very interesting viewpoint. Thank you.
Religion scholar Karen Armstrong, my guest on WNYC. Her newest book, The Great Transformation, The Beginning of the Religious of Our Religious Traditions. Taher in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Taher.
Brian, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm curious about how Zoroastrianism influenced Judaism, Christianity, and in turn Islam.
Zoroaster lived long before the Axial Age. It used to be thought that he was a contemporary of people such as the Buddha and Socrates, but now we think he lived a lot earlier. But he was, what he developed was a kind of dress rehearsal for the Axial Age. He had a very strong ethical concern, which is characteristic of these religions, that they were concerned very much with being good, doing good. There was a violence in his vision. He envisaged a great war against evil. He saw a polarized world in which two evil spirits were wrestling for dominion, and the whole of life was a kind of battle. Now, this certainly and they developed strong purity laws, which were part of this ongoing struggle against evil. You got rid of dirt and pollution because that was pushing back the frontiers of evil. Now, this certainly affected the Jewish exiles in Babylonia, because by the time you have the Persians coming into that region, and they brought their Zoroastrianism with them, and there's certainly both in Christianity and in Judaism and Islam, the business of the last day, the last judgment, which is very peculiar to the monotheistic traditions, where there's going to be a dreadful cataclysm and a battle at the end of time, and good will prevail, and the wicked spirit will be incinerated in hell. Very violent, nasty vision. This came in to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, not always for the better. I think this apocalyptic strain lies at the root of some of our more negative forms of religion today.
And I'm not going to take the others, but we have no less than 3 of our 10 lines asking about Zoroastrianism.
Oh, really?
So people are interested in that who study
It's in the first chapter of the book.
Another critic, Allison in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Allison's listening to music. Allison, are you actually... Okay, should we listen in? What is it? Is it Bach? Okay, never mind. Mark in Queens, you're on WNYC.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to Karen Armstrong.
Good morning.
I had told the screener that I wanted to comment on the Jesus hypothetical.
Would Jesus have sheltered illegal immigrants?
I think most definitely Jesus would do whatever it took to help an illegal immigrant. But I think the key is, I think he would do more than that. I think after doing that, he would go up to the house of the politician, the big wig, just call it the person who pulls the string, knock on the door and say, I understand you had this feeling of expressing such compassion to illegal immigrants. I just met one and they have a job, but it's sub-minimum wage. I'd like you to supplement their income. so they could live comfortably. And I have a second thing for you to do. You also said no one would be displaced by having this illegal immigrant show up. They don't have a job now.
Mark, you know what? I'm not going to get that far off the topic, but I appreciate your call. We'll do many, many more programs on immigration. You know, it is interesting, Karen Armstrong, how we keep going back to reference the founders of these religions for very, very specific contemporary political questions. So, such as, would Jesus have sheltered an illegal immigrant?
They are what's been called paradigmatic human beings, people like Jesus, Socrates, the Buddha, the Confucius, and that we go back to them to measure our own standards. And I think they have a very strong relevance and message for our time. And I think the fact that we measure ourselves against them shows their power. They are axial pivotal figures. Jesus, I think, practiced Jan I. He practiced concern for everybody, as far as we can tell from the gospel record, and he went after to help people who were marginalized and deprived and pushed outside the establishment. And Christians perhaps should remember that a bit today.
And on Muhammad being in the news over this planned execution that's now not going to take place. I think they kind of found a way to save face in Afghanistan by declaring the man unfit to stand trial for apostasy, and I guess he's going to find another country to live in. But at least those in a certain part of the power structure in Afghanistan look back and say, well, this is not in the Quran, but Muhammad has said you should execute Muslims who convert to other religions.
Well, a lot of these traditions about the Prophet Muhammad are late and of doubtful authenticity that are attributed to him. Muhammad didn't do this kind of thing at all. But this is a later development, and very similar. You'd have had similar conditions in pre-modern Europe. You wouldn't have had a very good time if you reneged from Christianity in pre-modern Europe, and people were executed and they were hunted out by inquisitors, because this was part of the political structure. And similarly, in the Islamic world before the advent of the modern period, religion and politics were one, just a part of your political allegiance. So if you reneged from Islam, you were reneging from the state. And the same was true in Christendom before. This is a hallmark of pre-modern religion. And modern world introduces religious freedom, but that hasn't caught on yet in other parts of the world for all kinds of complicated political and economic reasons.
So in Afghanistan, they're confronted right now with the fact that their constitution pledges allegiance both to Sharia law and to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Are they compatible?
Well, I think it's very difficult to introduce a pre-modern legal system into the modern world. And there are many, many Muslim scholars who say that this is impossible, just as there are very many Jewish scholars who say it's impossible to institute the entire Torah system and the entire system of Talmudic law in a political society today. It could be done, but it'll take a massive legal effort. And so just these sort of blanket appropriations of bits of Sharia law, it's just irrelevant, really, to modern thinking. And it also represents a cruelty and a coercion that, in my view, is absolutely antagonistic to any of the religions that we've been discussing in this Axial Age period, including Muhammad. Where Muhammad says quite clear, well, I beg your pardon, God says quite clearly in the Quran, in very strong Arabic terms, there must be no compulsion in matters of religion.
So you don't think that Sharia law has any place in government or is compatible with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Well, Sharia law was always a countercultural movement in the Islamic world. It was never part of the legal apparatus of a state until the Ottoman Empire made it the law of the land, and that was extremely controversial. And so the idea that you can't have a Muslim state or a Muslim setup without Sharia law is really not quite accurate.
Now, you get criticized a lot by people who think that you're too soft on Islam and Islamic history. Here's an email, for example, that came in knowing you were going to be on. It says, Islam is different, and it is not different because its followers are poor or oppressed. Islam's founder, Muhammad, unlike Abraham, Jesus, or Buddha, was a warrior who obeyed his own scriptural command to convert others by violence.
No, it's not true. And I may be back here in the... I've rewritten my biography of the Prophet Muhammad, and the new version will be coming out based on the latest research. He was not a warrior. But he was found himself, like many of the Axial Age sages, in a violent society. And he eventually brought peace to the region by practicing a daring policy of nonviolence, worthy of Gandhi. He stopped the violence, went into Mecca unarmed, and forced the Meccans to negotiate with him, accepting terms that his followers thought were disgraceful.
Isn't it true that even if Muhammad professed nonviolence, he also led men in battle and he inspired a great deal of violence? Within 100 years of his death, an Islamic empire had been established that stretched from Central Asia to the Straits of Gibraltar.
Yeah, these guys were politicians, not very interested in Islam. And indeed, after Muhammad's death, there was a considerable question about whether Islam was over, whether it had died with the Prophet. This was a political move. And these wars were not seen in any sense as religious. They were seen so by the Christians in the West, who watched this with astonishing horror, this progress of the Muslim empire. But the Quran makes it quite clear that there can be no, that all aggressive warfare is wrong, that the only viable war is a war of self-defense.
And so in our last minute, and to get back to the overarching theme of your book, you urge people of faith to rediscover these kinder, more empathetic elements of their faiths. But with all due respect, and you have my total admiration, can you, a former nun and someone who's written extensively about how difficult it was for you to believe, tell others what they need to believe?
No, I don't care what anybody believes. Anybody can believe exactly what they want, as long as these beliefs make them empathic and kind. And that's not my, these are not my little theories. I prefer to point to the Buddha, Socrates, Confucius, Jesus, Muhammad, Rabbi Hillel, as greater than I. That this is what they believed.
So have we entered an age when we should in fact cast aside the holy books and the ceremonies?
No, not at all, because the traditions may have acquired an awful lot of rubble over the years. And it's true, too, that many religious people try to shield themselves from the extreme demands of compassion by erecting secondary goals, such as dogmatic belief.
But we can find the values therein.
The values are there. We can find the compassionate heart that lies at the core of all our great traditions.
Karen Armstrong's latest book is The Great Transformation, The Beginning of Our Religious Traditions, published by Knopf. You're doing a reading. Do you know where and when?
I'm doing it tonight, Barnes & Noble Union Square tonight. I think it's 7 o'clock.
Thank you so much for coming
in,
Karen Armstrong. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.